Well, good evening. Let me add my welcome to Craig's. As has been said, my name's Steve, and work as a minister in training, and have particular privilege of looking after a congregation, along with others, over the bridge that divides in the Rylands. I don't know what you were thinking as that video was being played. But in my mind, as you watch it, it sort of creates in me lots of questions, questions that I guess all of us have to answer. Questions like, why are we here rather than not here? What is the planet for? Is it for anything? Who are we as human beings? Are we special compared with the animals? And what kind of life should we seek to live in order to flourish as human beings? Those are all fundamental questions that whether you'd call yourself a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist this evening, they're all questions that we've all got working answers to, really whether you've thought about them or not. They're the kind of the answers that you give to those are the reasons you get out of your bed. In the morning, if you do. I don't know. Maybe you don't. But when you are confronted with those questions, there are multitudes of answers, layers of answers, both religious and non-religious answers to those questions. And the sheer volume of answers to those questions is sometimes quite overwhelming. Certainly when I was at university and just the religious faith societies that occupied the universities was goodness. Someone that had grown up in a Christian home, it's kind of, whoa, what's this? You know, all these different ideas. And it's very enriching to meet people from other backgrounds, faiths, and beliefs, and all the rest of it. But when you're confronted with so many options, so many potential ways of looking at the world, then isn't it just arrogant, isn't it just tyrannical to say that one of those ideas, one of those systems, trumps all the others? And I think, particularly in modern Western culture, certainly if you pay attention to what we read in the newspapers or see on the TV and all the rest of it, the idea that to say that there is that you have access to truth, and one particular truth is at best naive and at worst tyrannical. I listened to a philosopher, John Hick. I think he works at Birmingham University. He says this, it should come up on the screen. We live as part of a worldwide human community that is at war with itself. In many places, men, women, and even children are killing and being killed in conflicts they both validate that are both validated and emotionally intensified by religion. And this is possible because each faith has traditionally made its own absolute claim to be the one and only truth faith. Absolutes can justify anything. Today, to insist on the unique superiority of your own faith is to be part of the problem. I think it was Karl Popper who said that it's a short step from confidence to the sure tyranny of I must be obeyed. It's a short step from thinking I'm confident about this to the tyranny of therefore I must be obeyed. One way that people often sort of articulate how a way out of this problem of so many religious ideas is told in a proverb or a story about an elephant and blind men. You may be familiar with it, but the story goes that there are three blind men, and they're confronted with this elephant. And one of the blind men, he grabs hold of the trunk, and he starts to sort of feel it and sort of run his hands across it, and he says, when asked what's an elephant, he says, well, an elephant is a lot like a like a large snake. Little bit moist, little bit smelly, but essentially that's what an elephant is. And so the second blind man has his turn, and he approaches the elephant not at the trunk, but he just has the sort of the body of the elephant in front of him, and he starts sort of patting it, and he feels it, and he says, "No, that's not right. An elephant is, well, it's more like a, maybe he's got one of the legs." He says, "Maybe an elephant's more like a tree trunk. I agree with you, smelly, yes, but not a snake. It's more like a tree trunk, solid and immovable." And so the third blind man has a go, and he's got hold of the ear, and it's flapping around. And he says, "What are you talking about? I definitely agree with you that this thing is smelly, but it's more like a large, floppy dinner plate." And so the proverb says, look, in each of the case, they're right, aren't they? They have access to the truth. There's some element of the elephant that they do understand. And so in some senses, they are all right, but equally, they're all wrong. That's often how it's portrayed. Another argument that comes against particularly religious people who say that this is the way that you should live is that all belief, particularly religious belief, is culturally determined. There'll be a next quote that comes up in a minute, and I'll just read that again to you. John Hick, in the same essay, says this: "In the vast majority of cases throughout the world, probably 98% or so, the religion to which a person adheres, and also against which some rebel, depends on where they were born. Someone born into a Muslim family in a Muslim country, or indeed into a Muslim family in a non-Muslim country, is very likely to become a Muslim. Someone born into a Christian family is equally likely to become a Christian. The religion which has formed us from childhood naturally seems to be, to us, to be obviously true. It fits us, and we fit it as usually none other can. It is true that there are individual conversions from one faith to another, but these are statistically insignificant in comparison with the massive transmission of faith from generation to generation with the same tradition." See what he's saying? So all belief, really, when you examine it, is culturally determined, particularly religious belief. If you grow up in a Christian family, the chances are you'll be a Christian. Who are you, Christian, to say to someone from a Muslim culture, you should become a Christian, given that your beliefs are as culturally determined as theirs? And so this idea that there are multitudes of faiths, that it's dangerous to say there's one way, that religious belief is just culturally formed, is deeply ingrained into our culture. It is what most Western materialistic people believe. It's the common idea. And therefore, it makes it very difficult for someone who's intrigued with religious questions to come to one of those faiths for answers to those questions. Particularly Christianity, where Jesus says things like, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can have relationship with God except through me." I can't accept that that's true. I can't even come close to considering that claim because of this objection. And so it's right that a church like ours, in the culture that we live in, allows people to ask questions of how is it that you can begin to hold to the sort of exclusive and absolute exclusive claims that you do, while your neighbours down the road are Muslims or atheists or whatever belief system there is. So what might a Christian say in response? Well, briefly, hopefully briefly, I say that, I might be lying to you, but briefly, three things. The first is just to push back a little bit, and if you'll permit me to do that, just to ask you a question. And the question relates to that story of the blind men and the elephant. I mean, put yourself in that story just for a second, if you can, do a little bit of a thought experiment. What position does the person have who can see that it's an elephant that blind men are trying to discover? Isn't it the case that the person using the illustration to show that, don't you see that all religious faiths are having access to some aspect of the truth, can't you see that it's an elephant? Would you see the vantage point that they put themselves in as the one that knows? The one that can see that all religions really are the same? Indeed, I would want to argue, if that's sort of the arsenal that you bring to the table, if this is your question, then I would want to say, isn't that as equally exclusive as any of the claims that religious people are making? Indeed, I put it to you that you could argue that it's actually more arrogant, if you'll permit me, in a nice way. I'm not saying that you are arrogant, but it could be, couldn't it? Because who is the person that can claims they see? And what do they say about other religious believers? That they're blind. It's everyone, really, when you push it, everyone, whatever position that you take, is making an exclusive claim to know the nature of reality and to know how people should live within that reality. Well, what about this idea then religious beliefs are culturally determined? Well, one of my favourite writers, a guy called Tim Keller, a quote will come up, pushes back against that idea as well by saying this about himself. He says, suppose we concede that if I'd been born of Muslim parents in Morocco rather than Christian parents in Michigan, my beliefs would be rather different. But the same goes for the pluralist, the idea that all religions are kind of the same or equally valid. If the pluralist had been born in Morocco, he probably wouldn't be a pluralist. Does it follow that his pluralist belief produced in him are produced in him by an unreliable belief-producing process? If you make the argument that all beliefs are the product of cultural forces, then so is that one. In short, you can't say that all claims about religions are historically conditioned, except the one that I'm making right now. Do you hear his pushback? Please don't mishear the way that I'm using that. I'm not saying that if you hold that view that therefore you are an arrogant person. Please don't hear that. But what I am saying is that you're just as exclusive as the Christian. You're making a claim. You're holding to a position of belief about religion that is not shared by the majority of the world. Certainly shared in our culture, but most people in the world are religious and don't think that. And so as soon as you say to us, you need to see, then you're guilty of the very charge that you press against religious belief. So that was the first thing that I'd want to say. And I'd want to say that if it is our heart's desire that we want peace and cooperation in society, if we truly want it to be the case that it's not awkward over a meal table with family to talk about religion, if that's what we're really after, then I just don't think that going down the religious pluralism route helps us. Kind of forces belief into the private sphere, doesn't it? It forces religious ideas or even any belief system about the nature of the world into private that can't be discussed publicly. And that's a very dangerous place for those beliefs to be because they're so fundamental to who we are as human beings. What does it mean to flourish as a human being? Why am I here? Is there any justice in the world? To force those into the private world is, I would say, not a way to bring cooperation in society, but confusion. And discord, perhaps. So that's the first thing. Everyone's making exclusive claims. But the last two points I just want to make is why I think Christianity is worth considering with this question of, in thinking about those answers to those big questions. And I basically want to talk to you and say two brief things about the person of Jesus. On the table as you go out, there's these little booklets. This is one of the eyewitness, a biography of Jesus based on eyewitness testimony. It's Luke's Gospel from the New Testament. We'd love you to take those away and read them if you haven't done so already. But it's really from this book that I'm sort of making these next two assertions. I simply want to set before you the person of Jesus and make two claims about him, or say two things about him, and then draw some conclusions for this question of how can you say that there's only one way? So firstly, very simply, I just want to talk a little bit about his character. It's widely said, and I think accepted, that most people would say that Jesus is the founder of Christianity as we have it today. Certainly, Christians would say that Orthodox, historical Orthodox Christianity is based on the early teachings of Jesus and his closest followers who sort of wrote down his teaching, explained his teaching, made his teaching public. And one of the things is, you read through these eyewitness biographies, and particularly Luke's gospel, that as you meet the people who weren't sort of followers of him, and the people that were followers of him, people were compelled and drawn to him because of his character. Certainly in Luke's gospel, Jesus seems to have held together, as you read about him, character traits that we rarely find in the same person. So you might be someone that's thorough and into detail. And often, if you're that kind of person, often that person comes across as nagging, don't they? A little bit annoying, a bit particular. Or maybe you're a laid-back person, you know. And therefore, perhaps to the thorough person, you come across as slightly chaotic and indecisive. Often courageous people that we know tend to be insensitive. And certainly, the caricature is that sensitive people tend to lack courage. But as you read through the gospel accounts, and particularly Luke's gospel, you're confronted with Jesus, and he kind of just holds all of these things together. He holds all the character traits that we admire in other human beings, but without any of the dark kind of underbelly. He's kind, he's generous, he's compassionate. Yet he is courageous. He's outspoken. He even gets angry with certain injustices that he sees played out in front of him. One writer of the 20th century, a lady called Dorothy Sayers, and I think she's basing this on Luke's gospel, particularly Luke's account of Jesus, just talks about Jesus' treatment of women, which Luke has a particular interest in as you read through it. And she says this, I haven't got the quote on the screen, so you'll have to listen. She says, "The women in the gospel accounts had never known a man like this man. There had never been such another. He was a prophet and teacher who never nagged at them, never flattered them or coaxed or patronized, who never made jokes about them, who never treated them either as the women, God help us, or the ladies, God bless them. He rebuked without querulousness and praised without condescension. He took their questions and their arguments seriously. He never mapped out a sphere for them, never urged them to be feminine or jeered at them for being female. He had no axe to grind, no easy male dignity to defend. He took them as he found them and was completely unselfconscious." It's extraordinary, isn't it? Someone who holds these things that we really admire in human beings, and he just holds them together. He's one that's full of authority and power. Great power, great authority, yet on one occasion is found with a towel around his waist, wiping the dust from his disciples' feet. One who is the fiercest critic of the self-satisfied and those that abused and marginalized others, yet the most kind and generous to those that were broken and marginalized. He's just, frankly, he's wonderful. But that's not the only thing that I want to say about Jesus' uniqueness, not just his character. It's a character trait that we don't see, I would argue, in... Well, if you don't think that's unique, maybe you could ask a question about that later. But then the second unique thing about Jesus is not just his character, but the claims that he makes. If I can ask you again to just have a little bit of a thought experiment, and I've used this before, so apologies if you've heard this before, I think it's helpful. But imagine that you woke up in this room and there were no windows and no doors. It was just the walls around us. And you woke up and you had no memory of what had happened before, of who you were or why you got there. Okay? Now, what would happen if we found ourselves in a room like that? I take it that there'd be all sorts of discussion and debate about what the room is and how we got here, what it's for. You know, the scientists and the engineers would be scraping at the walls to see if they're load-bearing and could there be something above or outside of us. And the geographers, like me, would be drawing the room and mapping it and colouring it in and helping people find their way around the room. The artists would be seeking to represent the mood of the room. You know, what's it like to be in the room and all the rest of it. And so it could go on. But we'd all be in the same boat, wouldn't we? We'd be in the room and none of us would have any idea of like how we got here or who we are or why we're here. That idea is kind of, I guess, a caricature of a way of looking at the world called naturalism. That all that exists is the physical stuff that we find ourselves in. We're in this kind of this box, if you like, this room of time and space. And so we've all got the same questions. There's nothing beyond, there's nothing outside. And so it leads to the inevitable conclusion, well, anyone that's saying this is why we're in the room must be ignored and avoided. Because how could they possibly know? It's compelling religious pluralism. It's enchanting because of that. And broadly speaking, and this is really broad, and I'm sorry about this, but there are three big families of ideas that explain why we're in this box of time and space, what it's for and how it'll be. There's Eastern thought, Confucianism, Buddhism, etc. And essentially, if this is not too much of a caricature, but essentially in those religions, they hold one similarity, that there is one essential unity between everything that exists. And the goal of your life is to discover that and remove yourself from thinking that you are an individual with individual desires in that oneness. So I have a friend who used to be a Zen Buddhist, and he's become a Christian. But one of the things he says is that when he was a Zen Buddhist, that he would say to his fellow Zen Buddhists when they met, he says, "I am you, and you are me." And that was the world. That was it. He said it's a very beautiful way to live. It certainly leads you to treat people kindly and generously because, well, they are you. So why wouldn't you? But all is essentially one. There's no personal God. It's just that we're all one, and God is one, and you are God, and I am God. The second broad view, I guess, would be what I guess is essentially regarded as true within Western, 21st century Western thought, that is naturalism. That we are here by chance. That at some point in the past, perhaps even the infinite past, there was nothing. And now there's something. And that something can be explained by chance and time and sort of collision, if you like. And then there's the third family of belief, which is where Christianity falls into the Abrahamic faiths. That before nothing, there was something, namely God, who created the universe, who made it. And so gives us standards for how we should live in it and behave and what life's all about, how we should flourish as human beings. But listen to these words about Jesus when you think about those three different families and think about this idea of the room. Listen to what someone who spent 3 years with Jesus, so the equivalent of an undergraduate degree, he spent 3 years with him, and this is what he wrote about him. He says this, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning." John, the writer of those words, talks about his friend Jesus and uses this word, literally logos. And it's a Greek idea that means the mind or the idea or the force behind all of reality. And John's saying that my friend Jesus, the best way that I could describe him is as the Word, the person who stands behind all reality. But it gets even more extraordinary because a few verses down, John says this about this character, the Word. He says, the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. The Word became a person in Jesus of Nazareth. That's what John's saying. That's the claim that Jesus makes on us. So do you see what's happened? We're in the room, the box of time and space, all trying to figure out what's gone on. And it's almost, John's saying, like someone has just put a sledgehammer to the wall and knocked a big hole and stepped in and said, this is who you are. This is why you're here. This is how to flourish as human beings. This is what's wrong with the world. This is how you're going to put it right. You see, that heaven's son became Joseph's son. That he slept under the stars that he had made does change everything, doesn't it? If that's true. I'm not saying that you believe it. But if that is true, then that is extraordinary. It just changes everything. That he would go on to say that the way to have a relationship with the person who stands behind reality is to trust me, to come to me, to rely on me, and particularly on my death and my resurrection. And you can ask questions about that if you would like to. But it is extraordinary what he's saying. C.S. Lewis put it like this. He said, if you'd gone to Buddha and asked him, are you the son of Brahma? He would have said, my son, you are still in the veil of illusion. If you'd gone to Socrates and asked, are you Zeus? He would have laughed at you. If you'd gone to Muhammad and asked, are you Allah? He would first have rent his clothes. The idea of a great moral teacher saying what Jesus said is out of the question. Lewis continues, in my opinion, the only person who can say that sort of thing is either God or a complete lunatic suffering from that form of delusion which undermines the whole mind of man. So you see what Lewis is saying? He's saying, look, the claims are too extraordinary to dismiss. But when you put those claims, I mean, he could be a lunatic. He could be mistaken. He could be, you know, frankly, not someone you want to listen to. But when you put that claim and you match it up with his character, well, you're left with a very difficult problem. Like, how do those two things fit together? I mean, there have been other people in the history of human thought that have claimed to be God. Don't know how, if you could list those people. Or if you tried to list, I don't know, the top 10, maybe the top 5 people who have influenced the world and the world that we know today, I take it you would put Jesus on that list. Whatever you think of him, he's been significant, hasn't he? But take the other people that have claimed to be God. They would never feature on that list. And yet Jesus is someone who sits on both of them. Now you've got to ask, how? You've got to, is that possible? Is that true? So in closing then, what does this all mean? Well, we started with, we've all got these questions that we need to find answers to. And really, we live out the answers to those questions, whether we think about them or not. But given the unique character and claims of Jesus, can I put it to you that I think, on the basis of that, that Christianity is a solid foundation on which to discover answers to those questions? And you can ask me questions about why I think it's solid later, but it's a solid foundation, given the claims, given the character. And more than that the answers you'll find, because of who Jesus is, are not just solid, but they're rich, and they're compelling, and they're beautiful. Second thing to say in conclusion, then, doesn't claiming to have access to the truth lead to oppression and tyranny? That's the charge that's put against us. And the simple answer to that question, when you're faced with Christianity as it was originally taught, as it's originally given through the words of Jesus and his original followers, and indeed perhaps even the early church, the simple answer to that question is it didn't lead to tyranny. It just didn't. What you find at the heart of Christianity is, as this one who is the Word, this person who stands behind ultimate reality, where do you find at the heart of what the writers want us to know about him? You find him strung up, nailed to a cross, praying for the enemies that are driving the nails through his hands. You find the early church suffering and dying for the sake of others, that others might hear about this Jesus. As you stretch into the Roman Empire, there's some wonderful stories, actually, of Christian people when a great plague broke out against the Roman Empire, in the Roman Empire, and people fled from the cities where it was worst, that it was the Christians, because of what they believed about human life and human dignity and indeed the person of Jesus, went back into the cities to care for the sick, many of them dying as they did so. See, any reflection on a founder of a faith that's praying for his enemies as they drive nails through his hands just can't lead to tyranny. Indeed, I'd want to say that Christians must never, and if you're a Christian here, you must never be superior or condescending. That must never be us. And if you're someone that's sort of seeking and thinking and you find that in Christians, you have my permission to blow a huge raspberry at them. For that must never be us. No, Christians are called to be people who follow Jesus through the shape of his death and resurrection, namely that they're to be forgetful of their own position and seek the interests of others as a priority. So I think there are three options with Christianity. There are three options open to us with religious belief. Three options particularly to Christians. The first is the one that we've kind of, that brings the charge, is that you should keep it private. Well, I hope based on what I've said that to keep it private is just unloving given the claims that are made. It would be profoundly unloving of your Christian friend to not want you to explore or find out about Jesus, given the claims that are made and the nature of the answers that are on offer. So we just can't keep it private, and really nobody can. Even the very statement, keep it private, is itself a religious statement. The second option, and sadly some Christians who I would argue don't follow the New Testament have thought this is the way, and that is to coerce people to believe it. You know, get enough people to vote for you, get in power, and then you can make everyone else believe what you believe. Well, I frankly just don't see that in the New Testament. No, it's not keep it private, it's not coercion. What the New Testament does say to us, though, is a third way, which is the language of persuasion, the language of dialogue. It's the kind of, can I show you Jesus? And you make your mind up. And I think, and I hope, that's the kind of church that we want to be as a Beeston Free Church, whether in the Rylands or here, is a church that doesn't keep things private, doesn't coerce, but just wants to say, would you look with us at these extraordinary claims?